My name is Ed Goldberg, and I have the privilege of talking to Tom Moon. Tom, welcome to KBOO and welcome to Portland.
Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. Now, the title of this tome, it's a real doorstop, is 1,000 Recordings to Hear Before You Die. This is the latest in the list of those kind of bucket list books, yeah. The things to do before you croak.
Yeah.
And I guess my first question to you is, how much did you have to pay them to get this gig?
I know, exactly right. I'm sitting in my cubicle at the Philadelphia Inquirer, the summer of 2004, contemplating another summer. I worked there for about 20 years and covered music for other newspapers before that, contemplating a summer of being out at shows four nights a week and covering the big records and all that. In comes this email saying, you know, we're going to do one of these about music. Would you be interested? Don't dismiss it out of hand. Let us talk about it a little bit first, as though this would not be a desirable thing to do. Meanwhile, as soon as I'm reading this, I'm already beginning to make a list.
Okay. Now, you have 1,000 recordings in here. How many did you actually consider before the 1,000 got winnowed down?
I threw a wide net, and for about the first 6 months to a year, I just took input from everybody. I would go to a cocktail party with a notepad, and I'd be like, all right, bring it on. Let's have it. What has to be
how many,
in this
how
book?
Many, how many people said horse with no name?
Luckily, not too many of my friends, although one guy who's a cardiologist said, the best of bread has to be there. And I was like, you're kidding me, right?
Did your eyes roll back in your head on that
yeah,
one?
Yeah, exactly. So I took that kind of input, and I also took input from a lot of recording artists that I interviewed over the years where, you know, at the end of the interview, you go, all right, tell me what you're loving, what I need to listen to, what's an essential recording for you right now. And, you know, when Joni Mitchell answers that question, you listen. Mm-hmm. And the interview I did with her, she was raving about Nick Drake. Now, this is years and years and years before the Nick Drake, mm-hmm. you know, car commercial revival and all that. So at its biggest, I'd say the list was about 3,500.
Okay, that's really not too bad for 1,000.
No, exactly. Yeah. Although, in some cases, what would stand in for the Beatles, instead of, I didn't list all their records, I would just say the Beatles, knowing that I would figure later which ones would turn up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the thing about this is, and I'm going to get into this in a second, no matter what you put in this book, something to say, what are you, out of your goddamn mind?
Exactly.
I mean, exactly. So I guess the next question is, since there are no true objective standards about anything like this,
that's right.
How did you make your choices?
Well, because there are no objective standards, I felt like I had to have sort of an umbrella criterion that would work for everything. Music that I knew very well, music I didn't know at all, which is, I'm a student of jazz. I read scores in music school, so I was exposed to some classical music. I certainly understand music and how it works. Didn't at all know the full repertoire of classical music. Mm-hmm. And so it had to encompass everything. It had to be the broadest possible standard. And what I finally realized was that first it had to be music that had some significance in its world. So in other words, not necessarily everything's going to be blonde on blonde in terms of moving the goalposts, but there would be some sort of, it would have cast some sort of shadow. Even a very recent record can have that kind of effect, like that band My Morning Jacket just has sort of got people thinking about the use of reverb again, how the vocals should sound in a rock record, that kind of thing. So that was the overall context question. And then the other question was simply, is this a peak experience? Is this something that I can play for someone who doesn't know anything about, is a complete newbie about music and is encountering this for the first time, doesn't have to know the backstory, doesn't have to know which B-side was which or any of the sort of arcana that often attaches itself to music, but just could be something that anyone who with an open mind would respond to.
Well, there's a couple of things here that first of all, I wonder, this is almost like a personal question, but I'll throw it in anyway. You seem to know a lot about D.C. bands, and I lived in D.C. for 18 years during the 1970s and 80s when they had their punk explosion with Bad
yeah,
Brains.
Sure.
And there was a lot of great local D.C. bands. How do you know them
Root
so
Boy
well?
Slim?
Yeah.
Well, yes. I grew up in D.C.
You did?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Well, all right. So
I grew up reading Richard Harrington in the Unicorn Times.
He's a friend of mine. He was my first editor at the Unicorn Times.
How about that?
I wrote for the Unicorn
wow.
Times. Okay, well, now we got that out of the way. I was saying, how does he know about Minor Threat? How does he know about these people? Okay. There are a few questions I have to ask you. And again, this is strictly like, how in the world did you pick this one over that
yeah.
one? The first one, since one of my other hats is a classical DJ.
Yeah.
The Glenn Gould Goldberg variations. Yeah. I mean, you know that was a controversial choice.
Sure.
Because I would rather have my ears pulled off than listen to that. So.
Which one, the early one or the late one?
Both. They're both bad for different reasons. Yeah. The first one is so rhythmically static that I can't bear to listen to it.
Yeah.
And the second one is just quirk. It's all quirk and Bach kind of gets lost in the quirk.
That's interesting. Yeah, I find that about the later one to a degree. But what I like about it is that he is taking it apart. And he's contending with Bach not as a strict text, the way, say, Sonia Dinnerstein? Her recording of it is text.
Right.
And great interpretation, but text.
Right.
And what I feel Gould's doing is sort of looking at it as a crystal and taking it from all sides and sort of saying, all right, there are moments where I'm not going to adhere to tempo. I'm not going to even try to do what I did in the early part of his career when he's, as you said, playing very rhythmically very straight, almost too straight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the first time I began to love Bach is when I heard the Swingle Singers do Bach. Mm. Bach swings. Well, yes, of course. So I've always viewed Bach as being rhythmically alive.
That's right.
And Glenn Gould just strangled a baby in its crib. So,
Well, do you like him on organ? Do you like the Art of the Fugue, his Art of the Fugue?
Oh, yeah. In fact, Toccata and Fugue in D minor is, you know, I mean, for whatever other associations it has, is a brilliant piece of music.
That's right. And his interpretation there is somewhere in between the two Goldbergs, I think.
Well, let me pursue this for just a little bit longer.
Sure.
Did you listen to Angela Hewitt? Did you listen to Alicia De La Rocha? Did you listen to Murray Pariah?
I listened to Murray Pariah. And I like that one a lot too. And I felt the reason to go for Gould over a more traditional, for lack of a better word, and it's not fair to call
it's
any
not
of
fair
those,
to call it traditional. First of all, it's on piano for one thing. Yeah,
but was this beginning and end of career bookend thing, and what Gould represents is so vast, and his contribution in the sense of opening up the repertoire is pretty important. And this piece, the fact that it was now available to hear the early and late together, really, that's what swayed it for me more than anything else.
Mm-hmm. Had you known the music beforehand?
That piece, just peripherally.
Uh-huh.
You know, I knew other Bach better.
Okay, I know you're going to hate this, but I just got to do this. We're going to go through you're going to get flowers and brickbats now, okay?
Hey. Bring the brickbats. We can save the flowers for.
it's a matter of choices. For example, right on the cover, you have things which have to be there, like the Beach Boys' Pet Sounds and Miles Davis's Kind of Blue, which I can make a good case is the greatest jazz album ever created.
Yeah.
But Sam Phillips, who I love, I mean, why not Martinis and Bikinis? Why Fan Dance?
Well, I think Martinis and Bikinis is a great record. It's certainly her most pop. It's her at her most florid and most completely developed pop point. Fan Dance is her L.A. Noir record.
Uh-huh.
And I think, I hope that people find their way to this record because it is not as disciplined songwriting-wise. Some are much miniature. There are a couple that last like a minute and 35, 40 seconds. But each one is a really developed, little, tiny, compact, haiku-style story. And I think as for her songwriting, and actually on her new record, she goes back to sort of a Martinis and Bikinis approach. But I think this is like so compact, it's so distilled, it's like it's Elroy, it's no artifice in the writing at all. It's just all meat. And you really have to let it sort of work on you because you can't almost even tell what the songs are about on the first pass.
Also, Cannonball Adderley, an album that took me through my early college years was Live in San Francisco.
Yeah, at the Wharf.
And you didn't pick that one. That's the one with Dishier on it.
At the Lighthouse.
Yeah. Well, Dishier is the one on is the San Francisco.
Oh, right.
Yeah. I can't believe you didn't pick that one.
Which one did we pick? See, now this is
you
the
picked,
bad thing.
You picked the Lighthouse.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and I like that. I really like that band with Victor Feldman.
Uh-huh.
And so...
McCoy Tyner isn't good enough for you?
Of course he is. Yeah. But there's I would take McCoy in his context. He's represented by The Real McCoy, which I think is one of the other great sort of hard bop documents that not everyone knows that they should know with Joe Henderson. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. I feel like with Cannonball, you could go any one of a number of periods, any of those early records. Something Else is a great record, too.
It is, too. Yeah, and with Autumn Leaves on it,
yeah,
that's a brilliant record.
Yeah, it's like Miles as a sideman.
Exactly right, yes. Let me give you a couple of bravos here. Bad Brains. I don't know how many people know about Bad Brains, but they were a DC band, all black guys, that started out as a hardcore punk band and eventually became a kind of a punk reggae band.
Yeah.
And who knows what they're into now.
Yeah, and they are back together and playing again.
Bravo for that.
Oh, well, hey, it's a great record. And like Fugazi and some of the other bands from that era, those records actually hold up really well. And, you know, we were talking about Minor Threat. Some people like the very beginning nascent moments for bands like that.
Yeah, when they were on Discord Records. Yeah. And yeah, right.
But I was very surprised because the Bad Brains' whole discography holds up. And it's one of those things where you can drop in anywhere. And even though they get a little better in the studio and they make, you know, I mean, I've heard on a couple of blogs people are complaining about the choice of that record over the very early, the first record.
Well, I have an autographed 7-inch of Pay to Come. So congratulations. Bravo for Narvel Feltz. There's a man who is nobody knows about this guy anymore. Yeah.
Another case of great writing, great production, totally different kind of thing for country music in the 70s, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. Bravo for Big Star.
Yeah. Bravo. That's a critic record, though. That's almost a gimme.
Well, yeah, but anything that what's his name does is okay with me. The guy from the Box Tops, what's his name?
Alex Chilton.
Yeah. Anything Alex Chilton that's does right. is okay with me. And that after the other songwriters left, that was his band.
Yeah.
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 Doc Boggs. Everybody should know Doc Boggs.
That's right. Yeah. I think that.
But you know Olatunji.
Yeah, and that record is a great record. You know, Drums of Passion, which is the one that I wrestled with. I didn't want to do Cage Matches, but I didn't want to say, all right, Beatles good, Mozart bad, or whatever. But in a couple of cases, there were a couple of records like that one where I had found other records that are very similar. And that one, the Mongo Santa Maria record called Drums and Chants, which is another one that not very many people know. But what that is, that's like the Afro-Cuban version of Drums of Passion. Right. And
is that the one with Watermelon Man on it?
No, it's just drums. It's just like actually the ritual chanting. What's the voodoo? It's not voodoo in Cuban culture. It is
Santeria.
Santeria.
Yeah.
These are the original Santeria distilled chants. And they, when you hear the two records side by side, it's like hearing. And actually, what we did with at the bottom of each entry, there's a little thing that says "Go here next." And I think the Olatunji is mentioned in the entry about the Mongo Santa Maria. But it was one of those things where, of the two, there was more variety on the Mongo Santa Maria, and it actually gave you more of an insight into the rhythmic foundation of the music. The Drums of Passion is what it is, and it's great, but it is very static in a way. It sort of lives in one place. A lot of that record lives in one place.
Here's a little factoid that I think you might know, but should
maybe
appreciate
not.
Anyway. One of my favorite records of all time is Desi Arnaz singing Babalu, Santeria God.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right.
Let me remind our listeners that I'm speaking with Tom Moon, M-O-O-N. Title of his big fat book is 1,000 Recordings to Hear Before You Die, published by Workman Press. It's one of a series of books of 1,000 things you should do before you croak. Louis Moreau Gottschalk is not in here, and I was hoping that he'd be in there because, to me, he's the ancestor to ragtime and therefore the ancestor to jazz.
Right. Yeah, and there's another case where is there a good single record document? Some of these, I listen to everything, all the Scott Joplin piano rolls, for example.
Wow.
And a lot of them are available. There's
Did you work
three
with
or four
the Smithsonian on some of this? Did you have to go to them for this? This is all
luckily,
commercially available recordings?
Yeah. Luckily, you could get most of these things. And in the case of Joplin, what they've done is like they did with that Gershwin piano roll thing where they actually reconstructed his performances So what you're hearing is as close to Joplin himself as we could ever get.
Right.
And a lot of them, and this is true for Gottschalk too, the playing is, it's so stiff that it's hard to recommend as music. Like, it doesn't quite work as a, it's not a pleasant listen. It's eye opening.
Mm-hmm.
You can learn a lot from it, but is it a pleasant listening experience? And I found one Joplin to be really good, but not all of them.
The problems with the limitations of the mechanical reproducing pianos at the time.
That's
and
right.
When they did the George Gershwin piano rolls, they augmented them. There was a guy there who knew, you can look at a piano roll visually and punch
see
out
where the, rhythmically
that's right,
it
yes.
was too stiff.
Or where the chord should be expanded or something like that.
I believe actually they did that with these Scott Joplin because it was very clear when it was swinging and when it wasn't swinging.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's almost like the piano roll didn't understand the dotted eighth note.
When did it ever come a time when you were putting this book together where you just couldn't stand to listen to music anymore for a while?
Believe it or not, no, and quite the opposite.
Oh, wow,
this
good.
Was one of these projects where, you know how when you search something on the web, you start someplace, and 5 minutes later you find yourself in another galaxy you never expected to be there. A lot of the listening and in the research of this book was that, where I'd be off in a jazz mode and hear something like, I'd hear like Watermelon Man and go, wow, you know, I really ought to do this thing where I find like a really good drum record that breaks it down and shows what it is. And then next thing I know, I'd be on Mongo and Olatunji. And there are many now more recent records like that, not all of them so good. And then after that, I'd be like, wow, you know, I really want to see, how am I going to represent Los Von Von, the great Cuban charanga, but not really charanga, actually, you know, everything band, dance band. And so then I'd be looking around and seeing which records I had and reading online which records the people who know a lot about them. I'm a generalist. So a lot of times it was like, who are the people that know a lot about this music and how can I get them?
Mm-hmm. And know? Did you have any trouble getting them? Of course not.
No.
Everybody was very happy to give you a brain dump on everything.
Exactly. And that's the other thing about this, where when I was stuck, I would arrange to interview an artist and say, all right, look, I need help. So Jeff Tweedy from Wilco, I spent an hour talking about the Kinks with him. And it was a fabulous hour just to really, you know, get the benefit of wisdom from someone who knows how hard it is to make records and who listened to a lot of these records in a more intense way than I had in the case of the Kinks, and really like walked me through some stuff. And a lot of people did that. Amir Thompson from The Roots, I spent a lot of time with him actually over the years. Pat Metheny, on and on and on.
So I got to give you some more bouquets and brickbats, okay? Do I really have to hear anything by ABBA before I die?
Yes. If you care about the art of the pop song, and again, keep in mind, what I'm trying for here is something that a newbie can, someone who is a blank slate. You know, I have a daughter who's 10, and I thought a lot about what does she need to have in her back pocket? And I knew that many of her friends were already into Mamma Mia and the whole phenomenon that actually has been going on now for several years was happening. And, I kept going, I don't like this, but I get why people do. And there is something about the craft of that kind of a pop song. And it does sort of fill in on the line, on the spectrum from the Beatles to, you know, whoever in more recent times, there is a place for ABBA. And my thinking is I wanted to make a well-rounded listener here. I didn't necessarily want to make a listener who was just a victim of my own taste. So there are things in here, even with choices where the group is something we'd all agree on. My favorite record is not necessarily always represented.
Another brickbat before we go to the bouquets. I can't decide whether what set my teeth on edge more, Jonathan Richman or Cat Stevens. Let's go with Jonathan Richman because he was even in a time when the DIY thing was very big. I always thought of him as a Boston smartass and a fraud. Do I need to hear Ice Cream Man one more time?
No, but you probably
Roadrunner.
You probably do. I was just going to say you probably do need to hear Roadrunner, even though it has been corrupted and it sort of now lives in the culture as shorthand for a lot of stuff that maybe it wasn't intended for initially, but. There's something crafty about that kind of smartass.
Mm-hmm.
And what I love about that record is that it so looks ahead to stuff that happens. I mean, you know, it's not to say that Graham Parker would have been Graham Parker without that record, but there's something about hearing that early Modern Lover stuff and go, yeah, realizing that this does set the table for a lot of really smart and acerbic and mean-spirited sometimes pop songwriting and rock and roll that we, you know, it too fits in a continuum. And I think, you know, if you're doing a history of punk in the broadest possible definition of the word punk,
right. You
sort of have to know that record, even if you don't end up loving it.
Well, you got to have Slade in there, too. Is Slade in the book?
No.
Uh-huh. What about, I don't remember, New York Dolls, are they in the book?
No. And I love that New York Dolls record. And it came down to, am I going to do all these first
glam
blasts
bands of,
you know, of all this stuff? And, you know, I'm getting a lot of grief from the Stooges fans that it's not Funhouse. It's
the first one, 1969?
It's Raw Power.
Raw Power. I love that first one with I Want to Be Your Dog. I mean,
That's great. But and Funhouse is actually probably the record where it hits the hardest track to track. But Raw Power, when you heard it in the way it was supposed to be mixed in the subsequent iteration of that record, it is pretty phenomenal.
The old Flamin' Groovies, the first Flamin' Groovies, are they in here?
No. They're mentioned.
Yeah. Well, they should be mentioned.
Yeah.
But here, let's go to the bouquets now. Thank you so much for remembering Jimmy Giuffre. Jazz fans don't know who the hell Jimmy Giuffre was.
Right. And he's another one where he turns up in crazy parts of the history and is important for also providing employment for Paul Bley early on. And Paul Bley is a major figure that a lot of people don't know. I think Paul Bley is one of those guys that in 50 years when we really take apart jazz piece by piece and 5 years by 5 years, people will be astounded at how much rich music Paul Bley was involved in.
Mm-hmm. And
Giuffre too. I mean,
if you're into what became known as the new thing or avant-garde jazz, Ornette Coleman wasn't the only source of that stuff.
No, that's exactly
by far.
Right.
Albert Eiler was a source of that, and so was Jimmy Giuffre. And that group who probably had a more intellectual European view of it, but certainly they knew what they were doing.
Right. And it was interesting to see how they triangulated from cool and this sort of much more avant-garde sense of harmony into
the Stan Kenton kind of stuff.
Right. Into something that it was not either thing. And it's definitely not European. Mm-hmm. It's definitely jazz. And it does swing, but it has this wonderful harmonic richness to it that a lot of people have missed and actually a lot of cool jazz didn't have.
Maggot Brain. Thank you for including Maggot Brain. And thank you for including Vic Chesnutt. Boy, talk about two ends of the scale on that one. Vic Chesnutt is a seek him out.
Yes, that's right.
Go into the used bins of your favorite CD shop and look for Vic Chesnutt.
It almost doesn't matter which record because there's good stuff on all of them. I mean, I like Is the Actor Happy as a piece of work because the songs feel very unified together as though he had written a bunch of songs at once. And I know he's one of those guys that writes all the time and maybe picks as he goes, but that's a really coherent record. And Maggot Brain, I mean, I felt like, you know, there were some like sort of large categories in the book. I felt like I had to have one entry where if you need a guitar solo to like really like turn the party out or change the mood in a room, there are many great guitar solos, obviously. Hendrix, a lot of people. But Maggot Brain, the Eddie Hazel playing on Maggot Brain is some of the most lyrical, beautiful guitar that we have.
A couple more. 13th Floor Elevators. Anybody who has not heard the 13th, but you didn't have the Sonics.
Yeah.
The Sonics, the great undiscovered rock and roll band from the Northwest.
Yeah, that's right.
Many kudos for Moondog. Many kudos for including people like Kathoom.
Oh, yeah.
Who nobody in America knows who Kathoom is.
Bob Dylan knows who she is.
Bob Dylan knows who she is. Yeah, so the true music
maybe that's enough.
Really know who she is. Yes.
I mean, part of our thing right now in America is that we know what's on the welcome screen when we go to buy our 99-cent track.
Right.
And we are not people like Bob Dylan who have a wonderful reserve of music and have encountered a lot of music. And our record executives now and our corporate entities now are not shining the flashlight on some of this old music and the catalog music that is so rich. And if this book can do a little bit of that and kind of advocate for some of these artists who are deserve to be known and are not known, well, I'd be honored to be part of that. I see myself as just a guy with a flashlight saying, hey, check this out, check this out.
Speedy West and Jimmy Bryant, nobody remembers them. Thank you for putting
Stratosphere Boogie. Yeah. What a great record that is.
Yeah. There was a guy in the 60s who started doing that kind of same kind of stuff too. I can't think of his name now because I'm getting old, but that kind of guitar boogie stuff is really, really wonderful stuff. And I guess one final brickbat for not including Cannon's Jug Stompers or the you know, any of those jug bands from Memphis, the Memphis Jug Band.
Yeah, the Memphis Jug Band, right?
Yeah, I mean, gee whiz.
No, you're right. And, you know, there's a lot of that. I mean, I'm totally fallible. And there's and there's a lot of stuff that I wanted that I couldn't find or couldn't fit. And at the end, it became a thing where how do I winnow this down? I mean, you know, some of my real diehard music freak friends have said, well, you didn't really need to put Britney Spears in there. You didn't really need like six Beatles albums or whatever. And my counter was, you want the whole range of it. You want a big range of the whole great. What's great about music is it can surprise you from a different direction every day for the rest of your life.
The jazz guys used to have a compliment, which was, you got big ears. You got big ears. That's, and I mean that as a compliment.
Wow, thank you.
One last quick thing here. Because the book is so eclectic, you have some really wonderful pairings. If you open a page, I'm looking at Arvo Pärt and Dolly Parton on the same spread.
Yeah. Right. Organizing it alphabetically does do wonders for that, because it's all music. It's all good. Why are we making a bunch of ghettos?
Right.
No ghettos.
Speaking of that, we have Public Enemy and Henry Purcell on the same spread.
Yeah. My favorite, also a hip-hop one, is Ernest Tubb, the great country singer, right, pioneer, and Tupac Shakur.
Facing each other, yeah. This, you know, this is the kind of book where you get a couple of beers and you open this book and you sit around for a whole evening yelling at each other about,
right,
what are you talking about? That's not right. That's you getting a lot of fun touring on this book?
Well, we're starting to get a lot of response on the website. We have a website where we're encouraging people to put up their
What's
own,
the website?
Oh, it's www.1000recordings.com. So the numeral 1000 recordings. And we're encouraging people to post, to comment on my blog, on stuff that I'm writing about, and also to post their own list or parts of their list, because there are no wrong answers.
Mm-hmm. This has been great. You know, this conversation could go on for 3 hours.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. And we need some lubricants after a while. The title of the book is 1,000 Recordings to Hear Before You Die. Let's hope not too soon. The compiler, editor, what do you call yourself?
I'm the author. I did have help with classical music. I had a guru there, and I had lots of help from other people, but I wrote everything.
Okay, Tom Moon, MOON, Workman Press. Come back again with whatever you do, because it's been fun talking to you.
Well, thanks for having me. This was great.